I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with the Deal, and today our guest is Randy Lesnick, the co-head of the corporate practice at Jones Day and an M&A partner. Randy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, David.
So we're going to talk about your career arc on today's podcast, how you got into M&A, pivotal deals in your career, both as an associate and a partner, your transition to partner, and then to taking on more of a management role as you continue to have a very full practice, and then issues you're focused on both for Jones Day and for your clients now. So with that, tell me a little bit about yourself and how you came to Jones Day and came to M&A.
Well, I always planned to go to law school. I was a middle child, and from a young age, my parents frequently told me they could see me being a lawyer. It may have been that I negotiated with them on any number of issues, but I went to law school, in fact, to become a litigator. Maybe it was the television shows that were on at the time. Maybe it was because I had done moot court and mock trial through college, high school, and law school. But I did a judicial externship my last year in law school for a federal district court judge. And he made the observation to me one day that I seemed to have the most questions and the most interest in some of the corporate cases that were before the court. And I was digging into issues that were more corporate and less about the litigation components of the cases. And following that discussion with him, it sort of piqued my interest. And one of the things about Jones Day that was particularly attractive to me was the fact that Jones Day has a program called the New Lawyers Group. When I was a junior associate, it was the New Associates Group, but I think NAG is probably not the best terminology, so it evolved over time. But the program itself is the same, where you don't do a formal rotation. You get to express areas of interest and try different things, but not with the rigidity of some of the rotation programs. So I expressed an interest in corporate and started there and never really looked back.
And that reflects a reality that many young lawyers haven't had exposure to practice and really have no idea what they might enjoy or not enjoy.
I agree with that 100%. Again, I always wanted to be a litigator. I did some litigation work as a summer associate. It was the 11th year of the case that was going on, and it was not Jones Day, to be clear, but it felt like pulling teeth to get some information out of a client to help them. And so when you sort of marry that up with what Judge Young had shared with me in terms of his perspective, it focused my interest in a way that I hadn't really thought about before. No one in my family was a lawyer, so I didn't really have any background in transactional work. And I was pretty fortunate that if I was willing to learn, they were willing to teach. And it started from the outset.
And so you spent your entire career as an M&A lawyer. So talk about getting into the practice, what you enjoyed about it, deals that were pivotal when you were a younger lawyer.
At the outset, I expressed an interest in doing transactional work and was pretty clear that I had no background in it. I was a history and philosophy major, and no one in my family was part of the legal profession. So people invested in me, and I got put on a transaction because it was moving quickly shortly after I started. I used to take notes on the side, because we didn't have Google back then, of acronyms that were being used. I didn't know that LTM meant latest 12 months. That just wasn't the world that I came from. But after meetings, I would go and ask either the senior associate or a partner about those. But I really love the speed with which most deals happen. The fact that you can do multiple transactions in the same industry or for the same client and totally different issues come up. And I really like the people component. You know, when I started my career, you'd have all hands in-person meetings where it was the lawyers, the clients, the bankers, the accountants, all in one place. And while that's evolved a little bit with technology and you don't have to be in the same place, I think there's a lot of interaction with a variety of people who bring different perspectives to what they care about in a transaction and why they care about it. And so that made it interesting and never boring.
And so talk a little about key transactions for you, where you felt you really grew as a lawyer and maybe reached a higher step of sophistication as a lawyer and as a counselor.
So I guess there's probably a lot, because I feel like I'm consistently growing even now. But as a junior lawyer, I was about a third year. I worked on the Capgemini Ernst & Young transaction where we spun off the consulting business of Ernst & Young and it was sold to Capgemini. So I was a third year lawyer. It sticks with me, A, because I saw it start to finish. It was obviously a significant transaction. So pretty cool when you have a family that isn't part of corporate America to be able to show them that the transaction I worked on was above the fold in the Wall Street Journal when people didn't read it online. But there was some irony to it and it always stuck with me because I got married on tax day during the transaction and it was the source of a lot of discussion and humor as the process unfolded. Also got to do some really cool deals. I'm a huge hockey fan. I'm an Islander fan lifelong. And I got to sell the Islanders when I was fourth year. But over time, I think there's some relationships that you build. And one of the greatest things to me about being an M&A lawyer is the people that you get to know over time and the way you feel vested. We sort of focus and the tone from the top here for me has always been client service. And so understanding a client's business and evolving with them. I started doing work for Reynolds when I was a first year associate and over time was the mid-level associate on transactions and dealt with shareholder proposals. And then I did the combination of Reynolds and the smoking and health business associated with Brown and Williamson Tobacco and formed Reynolds American. And over time, I evolved with them as their business and strategy evolved because I did the transaction where they acquired Lorillard. And then I did the transaction where they were actually acquired by British American Tobacco. And they've grown with me. We joke that one of my kids was my Reynolds baby because I delivered a couple of days early and shortly before the closing of one of the transactions that I worked on. And separately, I came back from maternity leave and I helped sell the Reynolds packaging business way back when in five separate deals. So they've seen me through a lot of life changes and I'm fortunate to continue to work for the Reynolds and BAT families today post-transaction. So for me, it's been a great experience to watch their business evolve and be a part of it by helping them on the acquisition side for that.
And that also means you become a source of institutional memory for a client like that, because you may have worked for that client for 25 years, which, you know, maybe longer than anybody in the room has known the company.
I think that's one of the things that I love about what we do, because we as a firm have a lot of longstanding relationships, because one of the reasons that I love what I do is the people component of it. You really can build relationships. And there's a number of clients that I've been with for a long time, different roles, wearing different hats. Sometimes it's being the governance advisor. Sometimes it's just the relationship side, but you really understand what their strategy is and how it's evolving. And to your point, I was just in a boardroom last week and something did come up where I had a recollection of when a transaction happened because I worked on it and it was a while ago. But things stick with you for different purposes. And there was a reason date-wise that this one jumped out and I knew exactly when it occurred.
Talk about the transition to partner and you're becoming more involved in management over a number of years.
So I guess I would say I've always been a little bit of a sponge. I always believe that you get more out of things if you put more into them. So even before I was a partner, I was on the associates committee, which was really interaction between firm leadership and the associates and disseminating information in both directions. Over time, I made partner. I continued to be a part of the liaise, actually wearing a partner hat with the Associates Committee in the New York office. I've been fortunate to be put on the firm's advisory committee. I'm an alternative fee arrangement partner, a risk loss partner. You wear different hats in different stages in your career, and it helps you get a better sense of the strategy, the rationale, the reasons, all the things that we try to do for our clients. And why wouldn't I want to be as invested, if not more invested, in the organization that I'm a part of? And so I've enjoyed every component of it. I was the admin partner when the M&A practice was a standalone practice. And so over time, when I then became the chair for the Americas for the M&A practice, and then when we made the decision to combine M&A and private equity and the fund group under one umbrella for a number of reasons, it was to me a logical extension and something I was privileged to be a part of leading, but the combination made a ton of sense. And I don't think it was a material change in what I was doing because I was always active and involved.
What do you enjoy about management as compared to advising clients?
So I would say I don't think of it as management so much as leadership. We're a working leadership team. And to me, some of what I love about M&A is the interaction with different people, the understanding different perspectives. I apply that also on the leadership side. So when I travel, I was just in Italy over the summer. I went into the Milan office to spend a little bit of time with the team. I've shown up in shorts and a t-shirt in the Amsterdam office several years ago as well. I try to spend the time and get to know people and understand what issues a market is facing, how a team, you know, I'm in a large office in the United States. We're a global firm. So I've spent time in a lot of different offices getting to know people and understanding what the practice can bring to the office. People may not always appreciate the skill set, but I know we've hired someone who either brings something new to the table that we didn't have previously. As our practice evolves, as issues that may overlap, I'm talking to people. So I get a sense both what cuts across geography and what cuts across industry. And I think having those conversations both with the corporate team and then other practice leaders really gives me a vantage point of how to anticipate issues, how to help direct and help some of our teams to push out issues that maybe, you know, people hadn't focused on. There was a long period of time, as an example, that people didn't think that shareholder activism was really going to take hold in parts of Europe because they had supervisory boards and they had employee boards and it was just different. And we heard that frequently. Well, it happened. They figured out, and a lot of those activists that moved into Europe and other parts of the world are in fact US-based activists. So understanding the playbook and being able to match up what we were seeing and educate the team that was boots on the ground that didn't have that experience, but show that we as a firm had a deep bench in that regard was pretty important.
You mentioned earlier that you continue to grow as a lawyer, and many lawyers say that, and that's a huge part of what they enjoy about the job. Talk about a couple of deals in the last year or two where you've felt that you've really grown as a lawyer.
So there's a couple that have jumped out at me as I think about this one. One was for a technology company that I've done a few deals for over time. Don't want to identify who it is, so I'll be careful in that sense, but we've done a number of transactions for, and there were challenges culturally on something that we were considering. Ultimately, we did not consummate the transaction. We didn't actually sign it, but we were working towards it and understanding and working with a client to identify new issues or challenges and helping them decide that while there are a lot of factors that they're considering, helping them navigate what their priorities were and what they started out with as their priorities and how the challenges played in was an important role to play. And I know I'm being a little circumspect. Apologies that I can't be more direct, but sometimes issues come up on a deal that really should be deal breakers. And there was a lot of discussion on a particular, you know, should we sign this up and go forward? And a decision was made that it wasn't the right transaction at the time because there wasn't going to be a cultural fit with the target.
And I'm assuming that that's a role you probably will only play as a senior lawyer. You're not going to find yourself in that role as an associate or probably even a young partner.
Not necessarily. That's a fair observation, I would say. But I think that as an associate, you don't always appreciate the value that you are adding and the role that you are playing. And I think, frankly, there are challenges too, right? Sometimes people think of you as the lawyer. So I remember actually working on a transaction, and I've shared this with our associates in our academy, which is a training that we do, that I was on a deal, the low person on a totem pole. But to the people that I was interacting with at the client, they were important people within the organization. It was clear to everyone that there was going to be some layoffs, but no one was talking about it internally. And I got a phone call from someone relatively senior in an organization asking me the question, did I have any visibility into what those transitions were going to be? And I thankfully had the forethought to say, no, that's not my wheelhouse, when in fact, I did have that information. But understanding, it was the first time I think I realized that people perceived me as a junior lawyer as having a level of information and knowledge that was relevant to them. And it helped me define my role in, it wasn't appropriate for me to share who it was that might or might not have been getting laid off as part of the transaction, but that I was actually valued because this person thought I'd have that information and was trying to discern information relevant to them. So I always say, like, I was dealing at any number of levels, and I have associates on my deal teams now that I regularly highlight for them the importance of understanding that they may be the third year, but our clients are experts in what they do, and we are perceived as the experts in the transactional side. And so they may be dealing with someone significantly more experienced than them, but those aren't people that do deals every day. And so there are judgment calls that the associate should make or should talk to the partners about making and understand the role that they're playing. And I think that that was an important realization for me, was I'm adding value. They don't see me as a junior in the way that I had perceived myself on that transaction because I was part of the team that was helping them get the deal done.
Well, and it suggests how unnerving M&A can be for people at an institution, you know, and how even as a junior lawyer, you may find yourself having to manage some of that uncertainty.
I think that's fair. And I think, you know, the good thing is we function as a team, so no one's in it alone. And I think that's important. I think that here, I've always felt like I had a safety net. I was always given opportunities and people would be there if I had questions and be resources for me. And I think the mentorship that comes with developing as an M&A lawyer is really important. It's something that I prioritize in terms of mentoring junior people. But I also think that you realize the importance of it and trusting your gut some of the time, but knowing if something isn't 100% or you're not sure, you're better off. It's okay to say, let me check, or I'm not sure, as opposed to just jumping in and making a judgment call that maybe isn't one that you're comfortable with.
Talk about issues you're thinking about now, both in counseling your clients and in thinking about the landscape that Jones Day faces and your group faces.
So I would say some of them probably overlap, right? The regulatory dynamic right now is really a challenge for our clients. You have conflicting regulations, you have inconsistent regulations, you have them across the globe, and you have different states even having different obligations when you think of some of the things related to information or data and what you can do with it and how you need to use it. So I think that it's presenting challenges and getting ahead of it and making sure that you're focused on it, not just from the deal execution like antitrust and foreign direct investment, but also making sure the board understands risk oversight, how the risk profile of the company is evolving and changing over time. That's one. And then the other I would say is probably, and I'm sure there's a lot, but one big one is obviously AI. I do a lot of work with technology clients. And so obviously understanding the importance of AI and the possibilities that are extremely numerous when it comes to AI, those both present unique factors and challenges. Technology companies understand artificial intelligence and Gen AI and what the differences are and how they work. There are definitely some times that clients are talking about doing a transaction, and when you get to the heart of what they're buying, they're actually buying technology solution. And to the extent it has AI capabilities, they may be buying a capability. And it's important to make sure that the clients understand what other capabilities that technology has and how different statutes may come into play in that context. But I also think that there's a lot of discussion about how AI is going to shape the legal profession going forward. And I think that there are ways that you can use AI in what we do that are helpful and creative across the board. And I think that being realistic about what some of the limitations of AI can be, AI is not a substitute for legal judgment. But I do think that AI can be utilized in a way to make certain things more efficient in the process. But when you hear about hallucinations or you sample products, and what you learn sometimes is, well, if you don't ask the question the same way, you can ask a question. If I asked one, David, and you asked it, and we asked it in our own tone or the way we would present it, we could get wildly different answers to the same question. And so understanding how to train people, how even as someone that, you know, my kids are pretty savvy when it comes to technology, and obviously they move quickly and it's a part of everything they do. We're open to technology and we actually utilize it with some frequency, but knowing its limitations and knowing how we can apply technology to improve client service as opposed to suggesting that it's a substitute. I mean, a lot of the technology solutions that we have piloted might be useful in English, but maybe not in some of the foreign languages that our other offices or that our client needs are. So understanding, again, those limits, I think is going to be a really important piece. And I am a big advocate of utilizing AI for efficiency purposes, but I don't think there's a substitute for understanding the issue and the things that aren't on black and white that can't just be pulled out of an agreement and plugged into a summary. I think you really need to look holistically at what the client's needs are, how this fits into the big picture. So I don't think AI is replacing lawyers, despite what you read from time to time.
So how do you compare AI to a whole succession of technologies that have been incorporated into legal practice? I mean, when you started practice in the late 90s, most lawyers were terrified of email, which changed in really a year period where they all got BlackBerries. And then, of course, they were completely addicted to email. And that's only one of many examples. So how would you compare AI to other technologies that have been incorporated into the practice?
When it comes to the practice of law, and we're talking about AI, I think it's just the speed with which AI came about. I think people talked about it and then it was here a little faster. We always used email, right? Maybe it was from my desktop and it didn't give me the flexibility to hop on a train, or cell phones that didn't weigh as much as they did when we started carrying them. But I think it was also the perception. People really, I think, came out, and some of the marketing was that it's going to replace. And it does maximize efficiency in certain areas, but it's not a substitute. And I do think that understanding how to use it in a way to best serve your clients is really important. And I don't think that suggesting that you should never use it is just not the answer. I think that that will be problematic for people that don't buy in at all. But understanding that it's not one size fits all. I do a lot of corporate governance work, and I always say that governance isn't one size fits all. But understanding what the capability is and the importance of privilege and how you use technology and what you're deemed to have to be competent in, that you shouldn't be using information that you don't understand. And I'm fortunate because we've got an incredible intellectual property and technology transactions team here that make sure we understand what the risks are so that we can make sure that our clients understand and appreciate that.
And then finally, talk a little bit about how you decompress from the job.
I have two kids that I like spending time with when they're happy to spend time with me, which as they become teenagers and young adults gets harder. And now that they both drive, it's less quality time in the car. But I have a puppy that I love. I like to read, and I'm a big fan of the beach. And to me, just being able any season to walk around on the beach and listen to the waves crash, to me, well, ideally reading a book makes a big difference.
Randy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
For Drinks with a Deal, I'm David Marcus.